Accession number 10420, rule 5.
Colonel W.I. Watson, Reel 5. Can you tell me your recollections of the King's visit, Colonel?
The King came down to pay a divisional visit, I think about the middle of January, and I came back from my Christmas leave staying with relatives in Gloucester, and the DAQMG, my great friend Murray Grant, said to me, pointing to a file on my desk, "Now that'll keep you going for some time. His Majesty's coming down to pay the divisional visit on I think it was around about the 20th of January. Happily, to our great joy, Banks, the ANQ, was in France, paving the way for our journey across the Channel. And so I had the whole thing to organise, the whole visit to organise, in direct consultation with the General himself. Now, January 1940 was bitterly, bitterly cold, and the monarch decided to visit the 150th Brigade, which I think I've said was at Stay-on-the-Wold, or Morton in the Marsh, I can't quite remember which. But, and the 151 Brigade was at Chipping Norton, and the Norfolk Yeomanry, our anti-tank regiment, was at Broadway, and I'm not quite sure where the motorcycle battalion was, the 4th RNF, but the Royal Artillery and Royal Engineer were at Witney. Now, the two members of either the Metropolitan Police or the security people came down to see me subsequently before the visit and said to me, "Now, do you realise that you are entirely responsible for the safety of His Majesty as soon as he steps out of his royal train at Kingham, which was where he was going to arrive, until you put him back after it's all over in the station at Witney?" And I thought, good heavens me, I'm responsible for His Majesty's safety for quite a few hours in the Cotswold before I get rid of him. And subsequently, just before, the day before the visit, I got a telephone message, I think it was from Buckingham Palace, the night before the visit, saying, "What are the roads like?" And I said, "Well, they're fairly, it's very cold and very icy around here." And whoever it was talking to me said, "Can you do anything about getting them gritted?" And I rang up the county surveyors of Oxford, Worcester, and Gloucester, and those noble officials got every corner of the road gritted that night before the royal visit. I couldn't tell them who it was, but I said a very distinguished person was coming round whose safety had to be made absolutely secure. Another person I had to go and see was the Royal Air Force Commandant of the aerodromes at Bryce Norton and ask him if he would make sure there was no flying overhead during the King's visit in this circuitous route, which went from Kingham to Chipping Norton, then to Morton in the Marsh, and then to Broadway, and then after lunch, when he came back to Burford and had lunch with us in Berry Barnes at the top of the village, he went off on his way back to Witney and saw the Royal Artillery and the Royal Engineers on the old aerodrome halfway between Burford and Witney. I remember too the adjutant of Bryce Norton got very snooty, and because I wasn't prepared to talk to him. I only wanted to see the commandant in private. I had with me the DAPM, my good friend Tony Gill, not Tiny Gill as they called him, and the transport we had was of course still only civilian transport. No military transport except for the general's car, but I was in Freeman Atwood's car, the G1's car, the G2's car, because the car that I was going in, Impress car, broke down, and so I had to lead the way. We did this trip right round, some 70 odd miles in the morning, and a few in the afternoon. We did a rehearsal, of course. Nobody was supposed to know who it was that was coming round, but of course it was known all around the countryside. And when the visit did take place, it was so lovely to see the school children all in the schoolyard waving to the royal car as it passed. And also there was an awfully nice scene I remember so well of a groom on a horse leading another horse with his bowler hat on, standing at a road junction, and as the royal car passed, he took his bowler hat off on horseback as the king went past. It was such a lovely typical rural scene. The military police that did, in fact, escort the car had their faces all terribly slashed with grit because the county councils had done their gritting so extremely well. He was very quick, quicker than we anticipated, going round 151 Brigade at Chipping Norton. And the general said to him, "Oh, sir, I'm afraid you'll be in a good deal quicker than we anticipated." And the king said, "Well, is there anywhere where we can have a cup of tea?" And the general said, "Oh, we'll soon find that. We'll go on now to Morton in the Marsh or Star on the World or whatever it was. Morton in the Marsh, I think. And we'll go and we'll inspect Brigadier Cryer's brigade of 150 Brigade. And then after that, we get a cup of tea." So Jack Milbank was sent on post haste to Brigadier Cryer and said, "Look out, His Majesty's coming much earlier, and then we're going to have a cup of tea in the Cotswold Guest House in the village." And that's what happened. We went, the little procession went round 151 Brigade far faster. And then we got into the cars and went to Morton in the Marsh, or Still on the World, I wish I could remember which it was. He inspected that brigade, 150 Brigade, and then when the police and everybody else were anticipating him getting into his car again and going off to Broadway, he walked down the village and we went into the Cotswold Guest House. Jack had sent a message to warn the good lady who ran it, who was coming, and all the waitresses were all beautifully dressed, beautifully tidied up, and there we all had a cup of tea and to kill time before going on to Broadway. But of course the king was deeply interested in the Norfolk Yeomanry. He knew the CO and he knew lots of the officers. And of course, spent plenty of time there. Then, talking to these people. Then we came back, and he went into the canteen in Burford, the divisional headquarters canteen, And then said, well, how far is it to walk to the mess? And there was no distance, just up the village street. And he said, well, let's walk. And he walked up the village of Burford to Berry Barnes, the headquarter mess. I went to the extraordinarily nice manageress of the Cotswold Gateway Hotel and had to ask her if there were any phony people staying in the hotel. And she just assured me there weren't. I had to tell her why, of course. And I then said to her, can I borrow a towel and a piece of soap for His Majesty to wash his hands on? And she said, yes, provided you bring them straight back to me. And the good lady produced the soap and the towel, which the king used in Berry Barnes to wash his hands, and I took them straight back to her. Now, I often wonder what she did with them. She was extremely nice, kind to me, because after the visit I got an awful cold, and not flu, but a very bad cold, and she insisted that I went into the hotel and she nursed me. But it was that's the sort of feeling we had all around Burford. And it's so important that everybody makes friends with the civilian life.
There'd be great excitement.
Oh, tremendous excitement. I was told afterwards that somebody had gone into the shop in Burford and said, they say the king's coming today, to the shopkeeper. And suddenly there were cheers in the village street. And the shopkeeper said, well, I think if you go out, you'll probably see him. And sure enough, this fellow went out to the shop, and there he was, walking up the street with the general to the mess.
Did he have an armed escort?
No. I suppose there were detectives, but they were certainly not in evidence at all. No, because I was supposed to be responsible for his safety. And during the drive, the 70-odd miles drive, of course I had these military police, divisional military police under Tiny Gill. There was sentries all round Berry Barnes, provided by the 6th Battalion, because I remember one chap let his rifle off and put the bullet through a chimney. It was so cold, his hands were so cold. The monarch looked at the seating list and he remembered everybody, who they all were. There were only 12 of us sitting there. And we had an extremely good meal provided by the Royal Army Service Corps, or the Catering Corps. And we all had a bet that the padre, the divisional chaplain, general, you might say, of the division, was frightful at never having a cigarette or never having a match. And we all had a little bet on that the monarch would have to light the padre's cigarette. And sure enough, after the meal was all over and after the port had gone round, padre took out a cigarette or something like that. And the monarch, king said to him, oh, padre, haven't you got a light? And lit the padre's cigarette. You know, we could hardly keep a straight face when Padre Newcombe's cigarette was lit by His Majesty. Well, then, after that was all over, after the meal, we then drove to Witney, where his royal train was, and the artillery and the sappers, I think, were all on a parade of an old aerodrome halfway between Burford and Whitney, and they were all, he walked all around them and looked at them and that sort of thing, and as he came to the gate on back to the road to the royal car, the whole lot were let loose, all the soldiers were let loose, ran to the road to cheer him. It was very, very impressive, and I think it really did deeply affect him. And then he was taken to Whitney Station, and there was the Royal Train, and I shook hands with him, and he said, "Thank you for all you've done." And I said to myself, "For God's sake, get into that train when the transport police will be responsible for your safety and not me." And that was his visit.
What are your recollections of his personality?
Oh, awfully nice. I remember he knew who McCracken was, and I think McCracken, Jimmy McCracken, the DADMS, said to him, I think he'd said, "I'm going to the 51st Highland Division tomorrow," and McCracken said, "You'll be wearing your kilt, sir." "Yes," he said to the monarch, "I don't really mind where I wear it. I think I'll wear it over my greatcoat." He was awfully affable.
So the king has come and gone, and your France is imminent.
France was imminent. Yes. We were ever grateful that all our, the junior staff officers, the Banks wasn't there.
How are you feeling at this time with your move abroad due any moment on the condition of the division?
Well,
because you're in division headquarters still.
Well, it had settled down now and it was working very well as far as we were able. I mean, when I got to France, as you will hear, I had to do all the movement tables for the whole division, from the assembly area where we assembled after landing at Cherbourg and to the move up to Lille and Rouen.
What were your feelings, your personal feelings of going overseas when this information came through that you were about to move?
Well, we thought it... one wondered whether we'd ever see the country again, ever we'd see England again. And... it was a tremendous experience. It was, we wondered whether what it was going to be like, and as I say, were we ever going to come back?
Did you have any
great adventure, you might say?
Did you have any lectures preparing you for for the move, or for what you might be expected?
No, the move came from higher authority. And how we were to move, and what trains, and that came from movement control. The divisional move did in fact move. The general had already gone to France, I think, when we moved. I left the division on left Burford on the 22nd of January. So the king's visit would have been around about the 12th or 10th or 12th. And I left with 105 other ranks comprising the hygiene section and the divisional employment tomb, which was the guard, really, for the divisional headquarters. And with me was the padre, Newcomb. We always called him the Archbishop of Burford. He had a parish in civil life somewhere on Humberside, I think North Humberside, I'm not sure. And Tiny Guild, the deputy assistant provost marshal, the three of us were the three divisional officers, headquarters officers, that went with this party of 105 other ranks. We went by bus on a bitterly cold, snowy day, to Whitney, and there we entrained for Southampton. Now, I think I perhaps might just read you, if I may, what I wrote in my diary regarding that departure, because I think it will probably give you a better idea than any I can tell you now. On the 22nd of January 1940, this day I left divisional headquarters at Burford with 105 other ranks from divisional headquarters, hygiene section and employment platoon for the BEF. In charge of the party, I was with the chaplain, senior chaplain to the forces, and the DAPM, Padre Newcomb and Tiny Guild. We entrained at Whitney with the CRE, that's the Commander Royal Engineers, and staff of the 235 Field Park Company. Very cold, travelled by bus from Burford to Whitney. The times and what has to be done prevent one thinking too much of the moment. But ever leaving Burford is not an enlivening situation. Farewells to the staff of the Cotswold Gateway itself are very trying. At Whitney, Mrs. Tiny and two other wives come to see us off. The former could not have been kinder to me for the last 2 days, for she has done everything to see that I set off on this unpleasant adventure with the maximum of comfort. She has done everything for Tiny too. I have never realized what a farewell of this kind meant to a really devoted pair. The parting was very trying, I think, to us all. She was very brave. The journey to Southampton was very ordinary, but what passed through our minds would be difficult to put on paper. One thing is certain, and that is that we all wondered when we would see England again, and where we were going to. All we knew was to France. A hurried lunch at the Southwestern Hotel, the G2, Harold Freeman Atwood, was there to meet us, and then on to the Ulster Prince, which I think was went from England to Northern Ireland. Travel, ferry. The other units of the division were the Headquarters Royal Artillery and the 4th Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, bringing the total of the boat up to 900. Just a sort of seasick entered my mind as I stepped aboard. We were off by 3 o'clock. Two other troopers preceded us. The men are everywhere and anywhere. Fortunately, the headquarter personnel having had third-class bunks. Each officer has a bunk and is very comfortable. Down the Solent, boat drill is practiced in a biting wind, from which it was obvious that were we to go to the bottom, most of us would never be saved, for the exits from below are far too small for the crowd and there are far too few boats to go round. With nothing to do, in a dead calm, I turned into bed at about 8:30. It was very cold and a bright starlight night, so before going below, I took a walk round the deck. Two destroyers and the convoy could be plainly seen. This really impressed me that there was a war. All the troops are quiet. No smoking was allowed on deck. The grimness of it all makes one feel resolute and determined to see through whatever may come along. There is no doubt that everyone is tasting something that they never experienced before. We waited for the boom to lift before proceeding across the channel when I fell asleep. I woke up at about 3 a.m. by the engines. I was woken up by the engines. And I put on a coat and met the Archbishop of Burford on the deck just as the boat moves off to pass through the boom for the channel, misty and dull. But the boom was plainly seen, and I passed the time of day with a private who was huddled on deck at a boat station. He said to me and to the Archbishop that there are mines in the channel, and he was taking no chances, and by his accent he sounded as if he was a pitman. He was in, waiting by the boat, so he would be the first in the boat. Then back to bed, and up again at 7, and walk round the deck in the grey dawn, and the convoy zigzagging its way could be plainly seen. Then we breakfast, and then we landed in France. We enter Cherbourg, and we gave the escorting destroyers a good cheer. So that's how we crossed to France. And I don't think I really could add much more than I wrote in that note.
Can I just take you back a little while? Did you have embarkation leave before you left?
I don't remember any embarkation leave. No.
And the
I had two sets of leave with my cousins who lived in a really lovely place in Gloucestershire. One was when I was given all the doses and jabs, 24 hours or 48 hours to get over there and stay in bed. And the other was Christmas. They're the only two leaves that I can remember.
What date, time, if you can recall it, did you arrive in Cherbourg?
We landed in Cherbourg early in the morning, which is just after breakfast. All the formalities of unloading took place, and unloading of cargo and men, even to removing, I quite well remember that, three cases of scabies in the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers. I can remember seeing them being removed away, taken away. We had a rotten meal and a rest in the so-called English Officers Club when we went ashore. Why the NAFE? I remember thinking, why the NAFE and a more English-like mess couldn't be run instead of the French trying to run an English Officers Club? I really don't know. It was a very meagre affair, and it was very difficult to understand.